Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour two of the show. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and at the controls right now, Jason Croft. This morning, we're pleased to have here in the show as our guest, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at University of Illinois. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And for quite a few years now, every once in a while, she is here on the program to answer questions. Now, when she is here, I always try to make clear right up front that we're not into extermination questions for this hour. We got a guy for that. In fact, Phil was here last week, although every time I say that, I also feel like I should say, ah. But Phil, you know, he's one of those people who got into what he does because he loves insects. And he always, or frequently at least, says, you know, is this a problem you can live with? Because if you can, then he would say, live and let live. If it comes down to having to get rid of it, he says, okay, I'll tell you what to do. But that's what that program is all about. When May is here, it's a different sort of a deal. And what we try to do is appreciate insects because they're just really interesting and they're amazingly varied. And the way that they live their lives and what they do is pretty cool. And we have to say that you might well make the argument that if there were not insects on this planet, we would not be here. So this is appreciate the insects time. And we're really pleased to have May here once again. So, if you have questions, have an insect-related question, you can give us a call, and I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. Maybe there is something that you have seen and you're not sure what it is. If you can give us the best description that you can, she'll see if she can tell you what it is, and other insect-related questions are certainly welcome. All of that is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number here. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for here, Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here once again.
Always a pleasure. I think it is my 25th year. I think I started in 1982. So.
Well, I'm sure that it was very, very early on, and my wife, Mrs. Inge, always reminds me that it was her idea to have you on the show at the very first, to do a program about insects.
Props to Celeste.
And I probably said something like, insects? What, are you nuts? and so we've been having you on ever since, and it's always wonderful to have you here. We appreciate
it. And the way I like to differentiate between me and Phil is that if it's useful information, Phil is likely to have it. If it's useless information, interesting. I'm more likely to...
Anything that enhances your understanding for and appreciation of the world, this is useful information. This is what we specialize here in Focus 580. We got a couple calls, and I know at some point I want to talk about bees, but rather than make these folks wait, why don't we go ahead and we'll talk with the callers, and then definitely I want to get the latest on colony collapse disorder. I know you've been talking about that a lot. We will start with Belgium, over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about bees, too, but I got to tell you about something that just recently happened last weekend to me. I regularly go over to an area southwest of Peoria, along the Illinois and Spoon River bottoms, where I go through woodlots and find down trees that I use in my business and turn into lumber. Well, I show up over there last Friday, and I am immediately inundated by these little tiny gnat-looking like things. They're about the size of a period, if not smaller. Now, these things are by the thousands. They're all over you. And I talked to the people who were there, and they said, well, they hadn't seen them at all until about 2, maybe 3 years ago. In those years, they'd only last 2, maybe 3 weeks. This year, they've lasted the entire month of May, and they don't seem to be abating at all. These little devils will get into your eyes, nose, ears, mouth, anything you can think of. Now, the natives over there say that they sometimes they bite people, sometimes they don't. I can assure you that they bite. My face and hands were exposed to the elements are just absolutely covered with bites and very unpleasant. Now, I know you don't like to talk about the negativeness of bugs, but we better hope these things don't show up here because the folks over there say you can't go golfing, you can't play little league sports. If they just stop everything. They're so invasive. And they called them buffalo gnats.
Uh-huh. That's what I was going to guess.
Ah, they are horrible.
Yes, they are.
Do you know anything more about them than I've just explained?
Well, they're called buffalo gnats. They're actually in the family Simulidae. The Simulidae are sometimes called black flies or buffalo gnats. They're called buffalo gnats because if you look closely at them before you slap them, they're sort of hump-shouldered, like a buffalo, only a very small buffalo. They are what are called they're different kinds of ways that biting flies can bite you. Some, like mosquitoes, are very subtle and use sort of hypodermic syringe-like mouth parts. These are not how black flies feed. They basically punch a hole in you and then lap up the blood and are extremely pestiferous, as you suggest. Like while you're flailing at them, they pay no attention. And it's an interesting kind of phenomenon that they are reappearing in places where they haven't been in historical memory. And the curious thing is black flies need clear running water. So a consequence of our success at cleaning up our environment is that black flies are back where they haven't been for quite a long time. Usually they don't do well in silty or polluted or slow-moving waters. So once you clean up water, you make it more suitable for black flies. And that's what appears to be happening in parts of the state that haven't had black fly problems for some time. The thing about, well, black fly bites not only hurt, but they can, I don't know if you've had the experience with they swell up and mm-hmm. alarming, to alarming dimensions. And it's kind of odd payback for being environmentally good stewards.
Oh, my. Here again, I know you don't like to talk about this, but is there... I tried putting off and stuff like that on. That they came to it.
Yeah, they are unbelievably single-minded. I mean, mosquitoes being kind of sort of spindly and in general delicate will avoid flailing arms. But black flies are very compact and very solid, and because of the way that they feed, they are kind of depend on kind of dodging and revisiting, and it's really hard to wave them off. They are extremely persistent.
Oh, let me assure you they are. Is there anything that is good to kind of at least keep them away from you?
To keep them away? Well, the deep woods off is the kind of standard thing, or to stay indoors until... You know, September, I guess.
So now they can actually last all through the summer.
Usually black flies are early season. They tend to come out while it's still kind of chilly in the, in the evenings. And they're not typically associated with the heat of summer. Sort of they cede that part of the season to mosquitoes. But frankly, with climate change the way it's been going, it's kind of hard to predict. My guess is they'll be bad in the early months of summer, but not later on.
These were insistent all day and all night. They were amazing. Well, I've had enough of your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
And again, under the category of useless information, black flies are extremely familiar to those who go up north for vacation, if you vacation in Canada. And there's, in fact, a folk song about black flies and an award-winning animated cartoon about how difficult it is to get rid of black flies.
Yeah. I was bitten once by a black fly. Now, as I remember this, it wasn't a tiny fly. It was a big black fly. I mean, it looked like a fly.
And it probably wasn't a black fly.
No, and it probably wasn't a black fly. Okay. The thing that I remember about this was that it felt like I was jabbed with a needle.
Yeah, that was probably a horse fly.
Ah, okay.
Horse flies also have this habit of feeding, like, you know, using a stiletto-like mouth part to punch a hole in you and then lap up the blood as it flows so freely it doesn't clot.
Well, that's what I was, and I think it was in New England,
Yeah, that horse flies
and
are big in New
we
England.
We were out in a kind of a rural area, and I wasn't really thinking about it. And suddenly there was this searing sort of pain, and I looked down and I'm thinking, what is that? And there was this big fly sitting there. That was really, it really hurt.
Yeah, the horse flies, that, you know, the two strategies that biting flies have. One is sort of subtle, and in fact, mosquitoes have inject anesthetizing substances. They tap into capillaries, and the horse flies and the other so-called pool feeders just basically punch a hole in you.
Phew.
And it hurts.
Okay. Yes, I wouldn't want to meet too many more of those, especially a whole horde of them, even if they were little. Okay. Let's go to line one, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Hello, am I on?
Yes, yep. Go ahead.
Hi. My main reason for calling was the disappearance of the bees. A secondary question was, I guess West Nile is going to be going up in frequency again because of the mosquitoes, and I was just wondering about general mosquito avoidance and control, and also Lyme disease, is the ticks. Mm-hmm. Do we have those ticks in Illinois?
We certainly do. Maybe I'll go backwards through the three. So we've got a tick question, a mosquito question, and a honeybee question. So in backwards order, yes, we do have the black-legged tick, or Ixodes scapularis, it's called the deer tick. And the tick is here. Whether or not the microorganism that causes Lyme disease, it's called Borrelia, is here, is not so clear. So we are at lower risk, although you can get attacked by deer ticks here. The incidence of disease-carrying ticks is much lower than in places like Wisconsin, and certainly in the northeastern U.S. My sister lives in Connecticut, not far from Lyme, which is the town that had the dubious distinction of giving its name to Lyme disease. She's had it, her son has had it, they think their dog has had it. So the ticks are common throughout the eastern U.S., but the distribution of the disease-causing microbe is patchier. And to my knowledge, unless things have changed over the last year or so, we do not have a high incidence of disease-carrying ticks in the neighborhood here, at least in Champaign County. And as for West Nile, this was a disease that first recognized in this country in 1999. Actually, it was killing flamingos and other exotic birds in the Bronx Zoo when the Bronx Zoo pathologist, a lady named Tracy McNamara, recognized it as the infectious disease that was hitherto associated only with Old World birds. That's why it's called West Nile. It's actually from Africa. Thought that maybe the strain that showed up in New York tracks back to an Israeli strain. So it turns out that West Nile certainly cycles among birds and mosquito vectors. It also, when the mosquitoes feed more broadly, can infect humans, which is sort of a dead-end host for them, as are horses. And we had an incredibly high incidence. I think we had the highest incidence in the country in 2000. And since then, the actual number of cases has declined in Illinois, and the peaks have moved west. But again, whether or not there's a high incidence depends on the frequency of bites and the frequency with which infected mosquitoes bite people. And it's been discovered since 2000 that there's a tremendous diversity of mosquitoes that can act as vectors, not just the Culex species that were originally described, but all kinds of mosquitoes. So it is something to be aware of. A lot of people may actually be exposed to West Nile and just never display any symptoms, but depending on what strain, it can actually cause major problems. So, and you know, arthropods are doing their best to make outdoor enjoyment of the outdoor a real challenge, I guess. So it's a theme for today's show. And then the last question, I guess, is a big one, is about honeybees. Did you want to hear about colony collapse disorder or something specific? Or?
Yes, I heard that cell phones are suspected.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. The cell phone theory is a complete and utter fabrication of an irresponsible media. And I say that because...
Darn that media.
Yeah, this was a story that appeared in a British newspaper, The Independent, and it was based on a mistranslation of a preliminary unrefereed study based on two hives that was posted on a website, not even published in a journal, and didn't even use cell phones. It was the word for cell phone in German is actually handy. It's not anything about cell or mobile or anything. And what they used in this study was a cordless phone, not a cell phone. And in fact, they set the base of the cordless phone in the hive, and of course it disrupted the bees. The two people who did the study were physicists, completely disavowed any connection, relationship, or anything to colony collapse disorder, and have consistently and continuously denied that, and it's still out of control. And I don't know why it has such traction or why this particular idea has legs, as it were. But interestingly, this was the one thing that the vice president's office called the USDA about for a briefing in terms of colony collapse disorder, this mysterious disappearance of honeybees. They wanted to know about cell phones. And there are many, many things to worry about in this world of modern technology, and cell phones are not one of them at the moment if you're worried about honeybees.
Thank you.
And thanks for asking.
And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. I also have another call and other questions about insects are welcome. May Barenbaum is here. She's professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And every once in a while she is here on the program. We talk about them, not so much about killing them, but about appreciating them if you can. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Rantoul. This is line two. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
I don't really have a question, but I found the most fascinating bug a few years ago, about 15 years ago, and I've never had a chance to talk about it with anyone. I lived in Marshall, Texas, which is about 150 miles due east of Dallas. At a gas station one day, my son and I saw this enormous beetle, and it looked terrifying. Well, we went in the store and got a container and, you know, didn't touch the bug. And it took me forever to find, is it entomologist?
Entomologist, uh-huh.
Entomologist, thank you. And described it to him, and he said it was an elephant stag beetle.
That's what I would have guessed. They do look pretty scary.
And he said they're not from our area. He said most likely it fell off some sort of hay wagon or something of that nature from, like, Kansas or, you know, it's something like that. Do we have them up here in Illinois?
Well, we certainly don't have the giant stag beetles, the elephant stag beetle. Maybe southern Illinois is probably the northernmost part of their range. They're Virginia, North Carolina, west to sort of the southern edge of Illinois and Indiana. I've never seen one around here. But they are very impressive for those who haven't seen them. The males have these enormously elongate mandibles. So altogether, they're about the beetle's about an inch and a half, and the mandibles are another half inch beyond that. And they look like they could do serious damage to.
They really do.
But actually, those are essentially I guess you call them love handles or something. They're used for in courtship, and the males will battle with each other, just like stags use their antlers when they display, and then they'll sort of carry female stag beetles around, pry other males off the bodies of, you know, desired mates, and very elaborate. But they don't, although they can, in theory, give you a nasty pinch. I never met anyone who was actually injured by a stag beetle. Mostly they just try to get away. They don't eat, you know, they're not predators or anything. Mostly they live on in decayed wood, so. Not like you need big jaws to wrestle down decayed wood and subdue it. So
right. Well, it was the most beautiful bug I've ever seen in my whole life.
Well, actually, stag beetles in general have attracted artists throughout the century. There's a classic engraving by the famous Albrecht Dürer in Germany of the European stag beetle.
Hmm.
And, yeah, they're pretty impressive animals.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I'm really enjoying the show.
Oh, right, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks for the call. I have a couple of other people here. I hope that they wouldn't mind being patient and waiting here for a couple of minutes, because I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about colony collapse disorder. It's certainly been in the news. I know you've been doing a lot of interviews, and maybe it was because of that first piece that you wrote for the New York Times.
That's
everybody
right.
saw that, and so everybody says, ah, this is the woman we want to talk to. And actually, I think we've talked about it before here on the show. The problem being is that the first sign that there was some sort of problem was that the colonies, the hives, were empty.
Well,
essentially
mostly empty, yeah. That beekeepers who were overwintering their colonies would go look in and see how they're doing. And normally a beehive is busy. It's like the stereotype where you have all kinds of bees. Bees are what is called, they have age-related division of labor, which means a bee emerges as an adult. And in the first few days of her life, she works around the colony. She cleans up. She takes care of the brood. And as she gets older, she makes wax. And then when she's finally a couple of weeks old, she becomes a forager and goes out and either collects nectar or pollen or water for air conditioning the colony or whatever else the colony needs. It can be guard bees. So they all have different jobs. And it's just like a busy, diverse community. Well, these beekeepers were checking their colonies, and there was just a pathetic little cluster of mostly young bees, no older bees, and the queen looking apparently healthy and healthy brood or offspring with plenty of pollen and nectar, which is truly unusual. I mean, it's as if the entire social structure has broken down. It's like you woke up one morning and all you could find in Champaign-Urbana were teenagers. So it's just very worrisome, because this is a very tightly regulated social structure. And usually when things kill bees, there are dead bodies left behind. So it's relatively straightforward to recognize what the source of mortality is. And the problem with colony collapse disorder is there are no dead bees displaying any obvious cause of death. So that's why and this phenomenon seems to be spreading. It's reported now in, I think, 28 states and throughout Europe and in Switzerland, let's see, Italy, Spain, parts of France near the border with Italy. And Portugal, it's been reported in Brazil. So it seems to be going global, and we still don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there was this wild, completely unfounded story that seems to be making the rounds about cell phones.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I seem to be overly, what's the word here? I don't know, aggressive on quelling that one, but I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten about cell phones. So,
no, it's good that we put the kibosh on that one. Are there some other theories, some other ideas that entomologists are at least thinking about or are pursuing that seem like they might offer an explanation?
Well, before we get to those, I like the word kibosh. Let's kibosh another one. And again, source of just uncountable emails from people suggesting that genetically modified crops, pollen from genetically modified crops, might be responsible. And I just want to point out, Illinois as yet has not had a diagnosed case of colony collapse disorder. And given that the vast majority of crops, at least in central Illinois, are either Roundup Ready soybeans or BT corn, you'd figure we'd be ground zero for colony collapse disorder. There is there have been many scientific studies on possible impacts of GM corn or other crop pollen. The truth of the matter is, in terms of corn pollen, corn is a wind-pollinated plant. Bees don't like corn pollen. Corn doesn't make pollen for insects to collect and distribute. So GM pollen is way down on the list of possibilities. The top four contenders, at least according to the USDA in a sort of summit of investigators that was held in April, would be a hitherto undiagnosed pathogen, a new disease organism, a new parasite, or a genetic change in parasites that are known to cause problems, including the two mite species that came in the 1980s and have caused major mortality in honeybees. Possible exposure to sublethal effects of some of the new pesticides, including a group called the neonicotinoids, which are neurotoxic pesticides that can have sublethal effects that interfere with behavior, such as orientation and navigation, which would account for why they didn't come back, or any combination thereof. Mm-hmm. So less likely is changes in the Earth's magnetic field, wireless internet, automobile grills, chemical contrails from jets, bee rapture, alien abduction, Osama bin Laden.
All these things, I'm assuming, have been suggested?
All have been suggested to me, yes.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow the story, I'm sure. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. May Barenbaum is with us. She is a professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, and every once in a while is here, and we talk about insects. Insect questions are welcome as long as, you know, save the get rid of the extermination questions, save them for another day. But if you're interested in learning more, asking questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I live in the Yankee Ridge subdivision. You were speaking of Lyme disease and its occurrence in Champaign County, and I just thought I would call and tell you that my neighbor's dog is being treated at this right now for Lyme disease.
And the dog hasn't been out of the county?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, that's not good news, is it?
Yeah, no, it isn't. No. And that was all I had to say.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, what's true last year?
We do have a deer population out here. I don't know if that makes a difference. It would seem it would, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, we definitely, we've had the ticks for some time now, so...
Well, her dog is being treated for that. That's what the vet said it was, so...
Well,
And I think they did blood tests and so on.
I don't doubt it. It was sort of only a matter of time, so...
Yeah, right.
So thanks.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's go to the next caller. This is someone in Mattoon, and it's line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping you might be able to help identify an insect that's popped up, probably about 3 years ago, and I hadn't remembered seeing before. I have hosta that are primarily in the shade, and this insect, the smallest I've seen is maybe a half an inch, and the biggest would be like well over an inch and a quarter. It's a long, more slender type insect. It's got a black head, a fairly thin, stiff, curved antenna, and it is a winged insect, and the wings fold over the whole body. The wings are almost black. It's just, you know, just off of black, and there's a thin, light gray line that goes all the way around the insect when the wings are folded up. It has fairly long legs, and... about the same time it started showing up, I noticed new chew patterns in the hosta leaves, and I'm just wondering if you could have any idea what that insect is.
So those wings, are they clear wings or
no,
are
they're,
they?
They're black.
So you can't. They're like leathery.
Yes. I mean they're solid wings, and when they do open their wings, when I've seen them fly, they're or looked at them from underneath, their bodies appear to be black as well.
So,
thoraxes.
Okay, an inch or so, you say?
Yeah. I've seen those. Probably the biggest is almost an inch and a half.
Inch and a half, black, and it's cylindrical in shape?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's long and thin. You know, it's not short and squat like a Japanese beetle or something like that.
But you think it might be a beetle?
No, I have no idea.
Oh. Because if it's leathery winged like that, and it's see, there's not that many winged things that actually chew plant material. So,
being in the shade, I also know that we get some slugs in there, and I know that they eat the leaves. And so, for all I know, these things are there looking for slugs to eat. But they don't seem to. I've never seen them, you know, actually chewing on anything. They just when I get in there to weed or clip back the flower bracts once they've bloomed, you know, they're just all over the place.
Well, I brought my cheat book along here called Garden Insects of North America by Whitney Cranshaw. And while you were talking, I looked up hosta, but it's not going to help us because it says leaf chewers for hosta are black vine weevils, oriental beetles, and milky garden slugs. You have the garden slugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you would never mistake, I mean, neither, the Oriental beetle is sort of Japanese beetle shaped, and the black vine weevil is a weevil. You wouldn't, I mean, right. They're kind of small. So it's,
And the ones that are at least an inch long, probably the widest point when their wings are folded up is maybe a quarter to 3/8 of an inch across at their widest point.
So they really are kind of slender and cylindrical. It kind of sounds like the adult stage of one of the cicid moths, like a vine borer moth, but they wouldn't be causing the damage on your hosta. So this is a tricky one. I got another cheat book here, and I'm trying to...
Well, if I can capture a couple, maybe I will.
That would be enormously helpful. And again, where are you located? In Urbana?
Mattoon.
Mattoon, yeah. If you find your local extension agent, or even if you want to mail it here to the University of Illinois, Phil Mixon, David has said, is the extension entomologist who has an encyclopedic knowledge of what can show up in your garden. And cause damage. So I'm still looking here for clearwing moth 298. so all you people have thought that I actually have all this in my head here.
Oh.
There are a million species of insects. So.
Yeah.
But there's not that many that are cylindrical and all black like that. But they're not, you say the wings are leathery and not...
Well, they're not translucent or mm-hmm. clear or anything like that. They're opaque. You know, they're not hard and chitinous, you know, like on a Japanese beetle or a regular beetle. So,
well, I'm afraid this one is beyond my capacity here.
You have to see if you can catch some, and as May says, and this would go for anybody, you know, wherever you're living. If you have a problem, you're not sure what it is. If you can catch some of them and go to wherever your local extension office is, they may be able to tell you. And if they can't tell you, then Phil is the guy that they call to do the ID.
Or even better these days, well, not even better, but an alternative to catching it is digital photographs. You can email.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really gotten quite easy now, much easier than it used to be, to do electronic, to ask electronically what might be affecting the garden, because often, people, even with the cell phone, you can get a decent image. And, of course, you might be disrupting their lives by exposing them to cell phones, but that probably is all right. So it's... an inch or so, only a quarter of an inch wide, black wings, black head, right?
Yep.
That one.
And a very thin gray, light gray band around the whole wings thing when it's folded up. When they're flying, they move too fast. I can't tell where the gray goes.
Well, the two things that come to mind would be one of the cicid borer moths, but they have clear, you can see through their wings. And the others are, there's a... group of beetles that are kind of soft-winged, one of which is gray. It's called the old-fashioned potato beetle. It's got lines on it. And meloid beetles, they're in that family. And some of those are black-winged, but usually not quite so narrow.
Okay. Can I throw one more at you?
I guess
so. There's another insect that we see around here, and it looks basically like a huge, giant bull mosquito. Like a mosquito on steroids.
Yeah.
And they kind of fly around, and their legs just kind of droop, and they got a long proboscis, and it just scares the bejesus out of me every time I see it, because I think it's a monster vampire mosquito coming to suck me dry. And
well, no need to lose any more sleep. Those are actually called tapulids or crane flies, mm-hmm. and they look exactly like hyperthyroid mosquitoes, giant, mosquitoes with a hormone problem or something. And they feed on decaying material. In their larval stages, in sort of mucky areas, water, where there's standing water, and their adults won't bother you at all, except perhaps psychologically. So,
all righty,
that's a good description. That's a crane fly.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll keep on going here. We have about 15 minutes left on the show with May Barenbaum. We have some other callers here. You have insect questions, you can give us a call. Next up is line number 2, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Where and when would I go in Illinois to see lots of cicadas?
Ah, well, better hurry. because there are two types of cicadas. There's periodical cicadas, and they're the ones that come out in huge numbers every 13 or 17 years. And then there are our typical so-called dog day cicadas or harvest flies. These are the ones that come out every year in August, maybe end of July, August. And there is the, I believe it's brood 13, the so-called Northern Illinois brood of periodical 17-year cicadas that are coming out up in the Chicagoland area. And it's just now, I think May 22nd was sort of peak emergence, and it's beginning to tail off. So if you head up north fairly quickly, you might be able to catch these. They really are impressive displays of there's just staggering numbers of these. If you wait here until 2011, we'll have our own emergence of 13-year cicadas. They came out in 85 and 98, and they're next due out in 2011. They're particularly spectacular along the Sangamon. But if you don't want to wait till 2011, you can go head up to the Chicagoland area.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And let's see, next is Broadlands, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that I've been listening to May Birnbaum on this station for a long time, and I was quite pleasantly surprised to open my June 07 issue of the Smithsonian and find that picture there and the wonderful article, and with a lot of humor and wisdom both. And that's all. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy the program.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye. That's why I love radio. I have a face for radio, as they say, and I looked at, when I first saw the picture, I thought, oh, it was a terrible picture. And ever since then, everyone's been saying it really captures you. So I guess it's not such a terrible picture after all.
All right. Well, what was the set? Was it about something in particular?
Colony collapse.
Okay. That's right. Are you starting to get tired of talking about that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's been an extraordinary opportunity to sort of educate the general public about pollinators and, you know, across the board, not just honeybees. And I am not, by the way, what was it? The foremost authority on colony collapse disorder is one literary agent emailed me to say you should write a book about this. I'm not even a bee biologist. I sort of ended up, the reason I was asked to testify before Congress, the reason I was involved, I wrote the op-ed piece, was because I chaired a National Academy of Sciences study on the status of pollinators in North America. I generally work on butterflies and moths. So it's pollinators more generally that I'm associated with. But just like all these causes, like, you know, Julia Roberts represents or testifies before Congress about Rett syndrome. Well, I'm the, I guess, Julia Roberts, as it were, of colony collapse disorder. So.
Well, we were thinking around here, I'm thinking that all of the people around the country, the entomologists who are bee people, are thinking to themselves, why is she getting all this attention?
That's what I'm afraid of.
She's not even a bee person.
Although, actually, they are probably very glad that they're not getting the phone calls and the emails and
hasn't Gene Robinson started to get some calls?
Oh,
he's the bee,
he is
our
the bee guy on campus, and he certainly has been getting calls and interviews and requests and the like. So,
all right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Champaign, line three. Hello.
Hi. Am I on the line?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, very good. I wanted to ask about what we had in the state before honeybees. Because my understanding is that honeybees are actually an imported species from Europe.
That's exactly right.
And so what was the situation with pollinators before honeybees? And did we wipe out some native pollinators when we brought in the honeybees? And could there be something going on as a result of this invasive species?
Well, actually, those are all excellent points. Honeybees are not native to the New World at all, and they were all the honeybees we have were brought over from elsewhere, and they were brought over by European settlers trying to grow European crops, and frustrated at their lack of success. So it wasn't until honeybees were brought over, for example, that apple cultivation really took off in the U.S. And they brought them over pretty early on, early enough so that by the 1600s, so by the 1700s, some people actually, some writers at the time assumed that they'd always been here. But in fact, the Native Americans call them white man's flies because wherever European settlers showed up, there were these honeybees appearing shortly thereafter. In truth, we have about 5,000 species of bees in North America that are native, that pollinate all kinds of things. They're not particularly well suited to managed pollination. And that's why honeybees are so heavily used in agriculture, is that they are the only really widely utilized semi-domesticated pollinator. We have people have used leafcutter bees to pollinate alfalfa in the western U.S., but in terms of manipulability, you can't beat honeybees. You can put them in a box, load them on a truck, drive them wherever you need the pollination services. You can, you know, make grow colonies big, shut them back down again. So they're very easily manipulated and transported and maintained. And there's artificial insemination. You can breed them for different traits. So that's why. They have these big colonies of 30,000 plus workers. So they have the capacity to deal with vast acreages of monoculture, which most of our native bees can't. So that's why we are so dependent agriculturally on honeybees. There are many bee biologists who feel that honeybees have, in fact, by their incredibly aggressive pollination and nectar gathering activities, suppress the numbers of local of native species. Whether or not they've driven any out of the picture altogether is difficult to determine because we keep such bad records of our native pollinators. But there are many people who, honeybee reputation notwithstanding, as our friend, really dislike them and consider them as invasive species.
Are feral populations a big issue?
Well, that's another good question. There used to be feral populations everywhere, but in the late 80s, when these two species of parasitic mites moved in, feral populations all across the country took a major hit. It was only really managed colonies that could cope with the onslaught of these parasitic mites. They appear to be making a comeback to some degree, but again, we keep such poor records of bees that aren't, quote, owned, that it's really hard to know how the feral populations are faring.
Do we even know how to keep those kind of records?
Well, this is one of the recommendations that was made by our National Academy studies, that this should be a major focus for attention. Because really, pollination services are not inexhaustible and not free, and they're, you know, not limitless. With something like clean air and clean water, something we should be aware of, having a need for, and sort of shepherding.
Are we to the point where we would be able to, if you know somebody in Congress wrote you a check for $1 million, you know how to spend it on this, or do we need to figure out how to spend it?
Well,
I mean,
I'll take it. No, you know, actually, among the recommendations has been to introduce pollination as a cross-cutting theme in funding agencies, so that in fact these methods could be developed and refined. And I think people could easily rise to the challenge. We keep records of other forms of livestock. We can track individual cows, you know. So certainly the technology is there. It's just kind of refocusing our attention.
They're a little bit bigger, but I understand your point.
And yeah, right, nobody lets cows out. So
and they don't go feral very often.
That's true.
Well, thanks for the call.
Goes out to your backyard and see, you know, cows wandering around. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I was you were talking about the fact that when they first noticed this problem, what they did was they opened up the hives, and there weren't the numbers of individuals that they should have been there. There weren't the older bees that should have been there. There weren't dead bodies. So you had to assume that a lot of those bees, they went off and something happened. For some reason, they never came back.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that because of the importance of these things, that you could actually say, well, let's actually go for hundreds of feet around the colony. You could go inch by inch, couldn't you, and look for dead bees?
Well, the only problem with that is dead little packages of protein.
They get eaten up by something.
Don't last very long out in nature. I've also had people say, why don't you radio collar the bees? And in fact, you can. There have been studies done on radio tagged bees. But again, it's someone has to be in a position to do this. You have to be clairvoyant and know which colonies are going to be collapsing in order to anticipate which ones to rig up with the radio collars. And I don't know that that's being done, but it's certainly feasible.
All right. Well, let's talk with somebody else. And this is someone in Sycamore, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I just have a quick question about cicadas also. Are they seem to be a very localized infestations. Is that right? They're not everywhere.
That's exactly right. They're, in fact, they're called broods. So different populations are on different time clocks. So the broods have all been numbered. I think brood 19 is our 13-year cicada here. And the distributions are quite patchy. Brood 10 was the famous brood, I think, 2 years ago. It gets a lot of press because it's very large in major northeastern metropolitan areas with newspapers. So Washington, D.C., Manhattan, you know, New York. But there's also a little piece of brood 10 in eastern Illinois. So they're all running on these 13 and 17-year clocks, but the populations are scattered throughout the eastern U.S. And you're exactly right that you can be in one county and there'd be, well, Sangamon County, for example, has many more of the 13-year cicadas than we do in brood 19. The next county over, there won't be cicadas. So, but there may be in another year. So there are different populations called broods, and they are differentially distributed across the country. So,
well, I'm thinking that it was even more localized than that, because I remember when back in the 80s when there was a brood of them in the Chicago area. I guess that was 17 years ago. They were so concentrated in local areas that you'd go a couple of blocks and there'd be none. And then you'd start hearing them whining, you know, a few hundred yards away, and then you'd go into a block where there were just thousands.
What happened in Chicago back then, another thing, 17 years, a lot can happen. And what's happening with a lot of these broods is 17 years, they go underground, and when they wake up 17 years later, they are not in the middle of the woods. They're in a subdivision. And all the trees that used to be, you know, a solid mass of forest, many of them are gone. So it's only those trees that remain that have cicadas in the roots that can produce cicadas. So the local population densities may vary with the abundance of 17-year-old or older trees.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And well, it's also one thing people have noticed, a lot of deformed cicadas, and they're worried about lawn chemicals or, I don't know, ultraviolet rays or something. But what happens when a cicada comes out of the ground, it's still soft. Its external skeleton, it shed its last immature skeleton and has these brand new wings, but it needs to pump out its wings. And typically they use gravity to help unfurl them and let them dry out. They need to climb up on a surface and hang to let their wings completely unfurl. Well, if tree density is low, they come out of the ground and they start crawling, and there's no surface, no vertical surface to crawl up. And eventually, their external skeleton starts to harden and it's not all properly unfurled, and they look like horrible mutants. So, again, it's the risk you take, you know, going underground for 17 years. When you come up, there may not be a tree nearby, there may not even be a house nearby. So, it's not some horrible genetic abnormality. It's just not finding a vertical surface to climb on.
Did they always exist here, or were they imported?
No. Those are native. There are not many places in the world with these periodical cicadas. People actually will come from other countries to see our periodical cicada emergences. You know, the Europeans who settled in the U.S. had no idea what was going on here. In fact, they called them locusts. You may have heard sometimes people call them locusts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have nothing to do with locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers that undergo these periodic population explosions. Well, the Europeans came over here and they saw these insects coming out in vast numbers and then disappearing. And they just assumed they were like locusts of biblical fame, but no connection.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much.
Right, thank you. We're coming down to the end of it. Just to follow up on that question, How far generally does a cicada, from the point that it emerges coming out of the ground, how far is it likely to travel before the point where it finds a mate, they lay the eggs, and then that's where the next, where the whole cycle starts again? Do they actually go very far?
Well, they not really. They're not, you might have noticed, they're not really aerodynamically incredibly sleek or anything.
Yeah.
They certainly can't crawl very far. They tend to just crawl a short distance and crawl up. Males can fly, and, you know, again, air can be pretty dense with them. But they don't move vast distances.
So I guess that's why I'm thinking that
the populations
would be likely
are localized.
The populations are localized because once they come out, they go into the adult stage, they reproduce, they get to the point where they can reproduce, they don't actually go very far from the place that they emerged.
Well, that's kind of the point of these concentrated emergences. You know, they don't have to leave. It's, you know, the only thing they're looking for is a mate. And, you know, the way the populations are structured, their best odds are staying where they are.
And I suppose that also is an argument for producing in large numbers, because if you're going to be concentrated, you're a target for predators. So you better have big populations, or else someone will come along and eat all of you, and then that'll be the end of your brood.
And in fact, it's this particular type of defense. If you look at a cicada, it doesn't have anything poisonous. It can't sting you. It can't really flee from you very effectively. It's called predator satiation. They basically come out in such vast numbers that predators can't get all of them. In fact, some predators choke to death on gorging on these cicadas. So.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have one more caller we can't take. Maybe in a month or so, May will come back and we'll do it again.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening.
May Barenbaum. She is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. Go look for her books, by the way. If you're interested in insects and their impact on their lives, you might look for her book, Bugs in the System, or a couple of collections of humorous and informational books about bugs. They are 99 More Maggots, Mites, and Munchers, and 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, published by the University of Illinois Press. Find them at any quality bookstore near you.